Justin. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes. We get paid, we astronomers get paid to think about the sky, things up there, and people might wonder, how come? Since we don't do anything practical, what's the significance of doing astrophysics, studying the universe? That may be actually a big question for you, young people that are about to enter the field. And of course, if an engineer designs a bridge and makes a mistake, that may risk the lives of people that go on that bridge. If we make a mistake in calculating the orbits of stars, that will not affect our daily life in any way. However, the same engineer will tell you that Newton came up with the laws of gravity out of exploring the solar system. And of course, general relativity is useful for GPS devices that we use to navigate. And so there are practical implications to studies of the sky. But there is a bigger importance to what we are doing, and that's getting the big picture. And let me illustrate that with an example. People that are born in a particular place that has a lot of rain might complain about the weather. They might say, well, we have a lot of rain in our place, and we're not happy with that fact. And then other people that are born in places where there is a lot of snow might complain about that. And in fact, some people might relate these climate phenomena to some divine intervention, that if we behave improperly, we get these weather patterns. What science brings to the table is the bigger picture. If we have a satellite image of the Earth and we are able to monitor the development of storms and weather patterns on Earth, we can in principle use the laws of physics to forecast what will happen in the future, and also to do things that may improve the situation that we are in. And the biggest system that we are in is the universe at large. So knowing about the big picture, understanding it, will guide us better in many different respects in life. So of course, we are sitting next to the sun, which is one star in tens of billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which is one galaxy out of tens of billions of galaxies out there in the universe. And understanding how we came to exist in this way has very important implications for our world picture. So that's what I'll try to describe today, the past and the future of the universe. And there are, of course, ancient texts that try to address this issue. For example, the Bible, the Old Testament, starts with the story of Genesis. That just illustrates that this curiosity about how everything started, having the big picture, was in the minds of people for many, many centuries. And now, for the first time, we're able to develop a scientific version that addresses this question. So the biblical order, I went back to this text after many years that I haven't studied it, and I looked at it, just reading the original text, and what is written there is that at first the universe appeared, and then light was separated from darkness, and then water was separated from the sky, then continents were separated out of water, and vegetation appeared spontaneously, and then stars formed, life appeared, and eventually people appeared. So then, if we compare these notes to what we know nowadays based on scientific evidence, the order of things is quite different. There is indeed a Big Bang. There was a time when the universe as we know it appeared. We don't know exactly what happened before then. Indeed, the universe was radiation dominated early on. So the first two points were actually not far from the truth. But the order of things afterwards got mixed together. And so if I had to grade it, if a student would bring this list to me, I would give it a B+. The reason that, I mean, first, there is grade inflation. I should apologize for that. But second, also, they got, I mean, the fact that there was a beginning in time is non-trivial. And Einstein actually thought that the universe, at first, the notion was that the Milky Way is the entire universe. So he tried to construct a cosmological model that is in a steady state, and immediately realized that it's unstable. So general relativity admits either an expanding solution or a contracting solution. There is no stable stationary solution. And it's a non-trivial fact that, the universe had a beginning. So that's why I would give it a B plus. And in fact, the initial conditions of the universe can be summarized on a single sheet of paper, and this is the sheet of paper. We have it. And it's quite remarkable that we can summarize those initial conditions statistically with a number of parameters, cosmological parameters, that we measured. And we can, in principle, feed it into a computer that will calculate how structure evolves in the universe and will end up with the complex systems that we have nowadays. In principle, the world politics, biology, everything should come out of this computer, big computer simulation, with this simple set of initial conditions. The universe was simple early on, and then complexity developed later. And philosophically speaking, it's interesting because nowadays, thousands of books in libraries cannot summarize what we find on Earth, let alone the universe at large. You cannot summarize it with tens of thousands of books. But these initial conditions can be summarized in a single sheet of paper. So how is it possible that this complexity that we find nowadays was all encoded in the initial conditions? How did this simplicity develop into the complex structures that we see today? And of course, the answer to that is gravity. And I'll describe it later on. And as I'll describe, the laws of gravity make the universe unstable, so regions that are slightly denser than the average become denser with time, and then you end up with bound objects. So here is an illustration of this. You have some small density fluctuations, like waves or ripples on the surface of a pond early on, and the regions that are denser than average become even denser with time. And they draw their material from the large volume that separates these dense regions. And eventually, these dense regions collapse to make bound objects. That's the process of gravitational instability. Now, of course, if you look around us, we have the sun next to us, which is a typical star in our galaxy. And the debris that was left over from making the sun ended up in pieces of rock that surround the sun. And these rocks combine to make up the planets, for example, like the Earth. So in terms of allowing life to exist in the universe, life as we know it requires the existence of a star and a rocky planet next to it that is made, in the case of the Earth, it's made of iron. And of course, to have life as we know it, we really need water. That's a necessary ingredient. And you notice that in the Big Bang, hydrogen was produced, but oxygen was not. So in fact, to get oxygen, you need to have nuclear fusion in the cores of stars. And the same is true about the iron. You would not have had it from the Big Bang. And so clearly, the universe was not designed to have the perfect conditions for life to exist in it, because if it were designed to have life, it would have water in the Big Bang. We would have just water. We didn't. That was an afterthought. Stars had to be produced, and then the stars themselves produced these heavy elements that later on allowed planets like the Earth and life as we know it to exist. So life is an afterthought. It was not there early on in the universe. It just came about in the later evolutionary stages of the universe. And it may disappear in the future, so we better enjoy it. And what I'll describe first is the past history of the universe. This is an illustration from a Scientific American article that I wrote of the photo album of the universe. We basically have an image of the universe at the time when it became transparent, cosmic recombination, when it was 0.4 million years old, in the form of the cosmic microwave background. And we also have images of galaxies all the way back to when the universe was 1 billion years old. That's a redshift of 6 or so, or 7. But we are missing some pages in this photo album of the universe. We haven't yet seen the entire history of the universe. And that's one of the frontiers of cosmology. to fill up these missing pages in the photo album of the universe. Now, of course, observational astronomers make use of the finite speed of light. It takes light a finite amount of time to propagate to us from a distant source. And the farther the source is, the more time it takes for light to arrive at us. So therefore, when we look at a distant source, we're seeing the image of how the universe looked like at an earlier time. And the farther the source is, the deeper we look into space, the more ancient is the layer that we're uncovering. And so this allows us, in principle, to do archaeology of the universe. Just like an archaeological dig, the deeper we dig into the universe, the more ancient are the layers that we are uncovering. And there is a maximum distance, of course, that we can probe, which is the distance that light propagated since the Big Bang. That's our horizon. But we can, in principle, image the universe at all later times after the Big Bang, as long as it was transparent. And the earliest image that we have is that of the cosmic microwave background. And that implies already, aside from other cosmological data, that the universe is not made just of ordinary matter. So let me explain. If you look at the amplitude of fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background in different directions, you can actually plot that amplitude as a function of the angular scale over which you're measuring it. So in other words, if you decompose the sky into spherical harmonics, then the multiple index of each spherical harmonic signifies the angular scale that you're probing, and then the amplitude as a function of a multiple moment looks like that. These are the data points from WMAP and other experiments. And what is evident is that the amplitude drops as you go to high values of multiple indices corresponding to small angular scales much smaller than a degree. The amplitude of the fluctuations in the microwave background temperature was small, and we understand it very well from basic physics. It has to do with photon diffusion. Photons were diffusing across small scales and were washing out the fluctuations. Now, if there was only ordinary matter in the universe, the ordinary matter is coupled to the radiation, and there would be no fluctuations in the ordinary matter on small scales. So the scales we are talking about correspond to roughly 200 megaparsecs, less than 200 megaparsecs today. Galaxies like the Milky Way are assembled from scales of order a megaparsec. So if there was only ordinary matter, there would have been no galaxies. The Milky Way would never exist because there would have been no seed fluctuations on the scales that are relevant to assembling galaxies. The only reason that we do have galaxies is because there was some other form of matter, we call it the dark matter, that did not couple to the radiation, and it kept memory of the initial fluctuations on small scales. It was not washed out because of its coupling to the radiation. So there must be a substance out there which is not coupled to the radiation and therefore had fluctuations on small scales that led to the formation of galaxies into which the ordinary matter assembled later. And you can see here that at a redshift of 1,000, the dark matter made of order 2/3 of the matter, of the mass density, the budget, the mass budget in the universe back then. Now, from observing the cosmic microwave background, we also, in principle, can measure the polarization, and WMAP provided evidence that the universe was ionized once again. Not only that it recombined at the redshift of 1,000, but it was ionized about 400 million years after the Big Bang. And this presumably took place as a result of the formation of the first stars. We haven't yet observed the first stars, as I mentioned, but we can simulate them on the computer because the initial conditions that the universe started from are very well defined. We can feed it into a computer and see how the first condensations of gas form in the universe. And what you find is that there are these filaments and sheets that are intersecting each other. And at some point, the density reaches a high enough threshold that you form the first condensations of gas. And in those, you make the first stars. And that happens around the redshift of 50 or so. The very first stars were made. And then the process grew up exponentially subsequently. Now, in terms of observing this process, you can think about two approaches. You can survey the star clusters, the very first star clusters, with a big enough telescope, or you can survey the gas, which is distributed in between those star clusters. And both of these approaches will be followed in the future. So let me describe the first one, which is observing the stars. The deepest image that we have of the universe came from the Hubble Space Telescope. And in fact, that was just a coincidence that the Hubble Space Telescope was used for that purpose. The director of Space Telescope Science Institute invited a number of astronomers to his office. He had some discretionary time, and he didn't know what to do with it, and asked for their advice. And each of them said something different. Each of them wanted to pursue the research topic that they're working on. So there was no consensus by the afternoon, and then someone out of desperation said, well, since we don't agree on what needs to be done, why don't we just point the telescope in a blank region of the sky and integrate for as long as we can, which is the dumbest thing you can do with a telescope. You don't have any target in mind. And then that's what they did, and that led to one of the important results from the Hubble Space Telescope, which is called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. It's the deepest image we have of the universe, and it includes, of course, among all the galaxies that are out there, many of which are relatively nearby, it includes some very red dots, which represent galaxies at the highest redshifts we have seen so far. And this is just a gallery of those galaxies. Of course, there are many of them, and you can go after taking this image, you can go to the location of these galaxies and take spectra and measure the redshifts of these galaxies and infer how far back are these galaxies observed. And we have seen galaxies out to a redshift of 6 or 7 in those images. And they look peculiar. They look different than the galaxies nearby. Most of them are disturbed. They have clumpy star formation. And aside from looking at galaxies, collections of stars, we can also look at an individual star, one star at a time. And that's by observing the so-called gamma ray bursts. These are the brightest explosions in the universe. And the most popular model to explain them is illustrated here. What happens is that the progenitor is a massive star. And the core of the massive star eventually consumes its nuclear fuel, and it collapses to make a black hole. And then as you make the black hole, if the material that makes the black hole has enough angular momentum, you make a disk around the black hole, and you get jets being produced perpendicular to the disk. We see this phenomena happening in quasars, much bigger versions of these black holes. So it's quite natural to get jets out of accretion onto black holes. And the difference is that here you have the black hole in the middle of a star. It's buried at the core of a star. And these jets, which are moving close to the speed of light, penetrate through the envelope of the star. They drill a hole in the star and eventually exit from the envelope. And if an observer happens to lie along the direction of the jet, the observer can see a gamma ray burst. And we can see those bursts out to cosmological distances. And we observe them in the gamma rays, which are the highest energy photons that we can detect. But also later on, there is an afterglow that starts in the UV, the X-rays, and then UV, and then optical, infrared, and eventually radio. So the wavelength gets longer and longer as time goes on. And for example, this is a burst that was detected very recently, the highest redshift one, is at the redshift of 8.3. This is the highest redshift object that we have identified so far. And it's a single star rather than a galaxy. The future is with a successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's called the James Webb Space Telescope. and that's an illustration of that telescope. It's supposed to be launched in 2013. And you can read here the details about this telescope. 6.5 meters, it will be sensitive mostly to the infrared, and it will be an ideal discovery machine for these very first galaxies. So one of the objectives of this telescope is to observe the very first galaxies. And of course, people on the ground are planning to build bigger telescopes than are currently available. There are basically two designs and three teams, three different groups that are trying to raise funds for such telescopes. On the top left here is the design of the Giant Magellan Telescope. Seven mirrors, each of them has a diameter of 8.4 meters. And then there is the 30-meter telescope, which is made of many segments, similar to the Keck telescope, but of a bigger size. In this case, 30 meters in the American design and 42 meters in the European design. So the Europeans are much more ambitious. We shall see if they will raise the funds necessary to achieve this goal. Now, aside from observing individual sources like galaxies or black holes, we can observe the diffuse gas that is in between galaxies. And this is an artist's illustration of what may have happened early on. The very first galaxies formed, and the stars in them produced ultraviolet photons that ionized the gas in their vicinity, broke the hydrogen into free electrons and free protons. And it's sort of like a first-order phase transition. You have nucleation sites, and those sources are producing bubbles of ionized gas. And these bubbles are basically converting the neutral phase into the ionized phase. And eventually, these bubbles grow in size because more and more galaxies are being formed, and you get groups or clusters of galaxies making yet bigger and bigger bubbles that eventually overlap, and then the universe as a whole gets fully ionized. So this is a phase transition that the universe went through as a result of the formation of the first galaxies. And if you were to look at the diffuse cosmic gas, what you would find is that at early times, you would have mostly neutral hydrogen, atomic hydrogen, illustrated here in yellow, and these are snapshots at different times. And the hydrogen, of course, early on was not uniform. It had some density fluctuations in it, so that's why you have some white regions here. But then as soon as the first galaxies formed, there were these cavities of neutral hydrogen that are deficient in atomic hydrogen forming around those galaxies, illustrated here in red. And these are the ionized bubbles that I was talking about. And eventually, these bubbles overlapped. Now, one way to observe atomic hydrogen is using the 21-centimeter line. So let me introduce you to this, the atomic physics associated with this line. Basically, the hydrogen, the ground state of hydrogen has two states. You can have the electron spin being anti-aligned relative to the proton spin, which gives you a lower energy state than the state where the two spins are aligned. And the energy difference between the two states corresponds to a wavelength of 21 centimeters or a frequency of 1.4 gigahertz. This was predicted back in 1944 and was observed actually at Harvard by Ewan and Purcell out of a window in the physics department. They just looked, opened the window, stuck a horn through it, and looked at the sky and saw the Milky Way galaxy in this line, which is quite remarkable. In this context, what matters is, of course, how many atoms are excited relative to the truly ground state of hydrogen. And people define the so-called spin temperature, which tells you the number of atoms in the upper state versus the lower state, in terms of some spin degeneracy factors and a Boltzmann factor, an exponential factor, which has the transition energy corresponding to a fraction of a degree Kelvin, 0.07 degrees Kelvin, relative to this spin temperature. And the degeneracy factors add up a factor of 3 in front of the exponent here. So now to figure out how many atoms are excited, of course, you need to take into account atomic collisions, which couple the spin temperature to the gas kinetic temperature. And you also need to consider the coupling to the microwave background, to the radiation, which couples the spin temperature to the microwave background temperature. And the microwave background temperature need not be the same as the gas kinetic temperature. Therefore, you can see the hydrogen in principle either in absorption, if it's cooler than the microwave background, or in emission, if it's hotter. And what we are observing is, of course, the 21 centimeter line in the rest frame of the atom, but then stretched by the cosmic expansion by a factor of 1 plus z. So by observing at different wavelengths, we can actually slice the universe at different redshifts, similar to slicing Swiss cheese, because we imagine these bubbles of ionized gas being formed by the first galaxies. These are just like the holes in the Swiss cheese. And then as we slice the Swiss cheese, we can see how the bubbles developed with cosmic time. So let me show you an example from a computer simulation of how these bubbles developed. What you see here are snapshots at different times. For example, here on the left, or in the top panel, you can see as a function of redshift, redshift goes down to the left. You can see how the population of bubbles grows, and eventually these bubbles overlap. So let me show you how the ionized fraction evolves with cosmic time from computer simulations. These are state-of-the-art simulations. You need to include radiative transfer as well as follow the evolution of structure. And in black is the neutral gas, and in red is the ionized gas. And you can see how the bubbles grow with time, and the process is highly inhomogeneous, non-uniform. And then by redshift of 6 or so, the entire gas is fully ionized. Now, in principle, what we would like to do in studying the diffuse gas is separate elements of the physics, fundamental physics, from the astrophysics. And for that purpose, I need to define what I mean by physics versus astrophysics. By physics, I mean the initial conditions from inflation or from whatever existed in the early universe, the nature of the dark matter and the dark energy, the kind of things that you heard about in this summer school. By astrophysics, what I mean is anything to do with star formation. Now, it's not to say that star formation does not follow the laws of physics. It's just that the process is very complex. And so we can't relate the properties of stars directly to the initial conditions in a simple way. And that's why it's better to avoid stars if you're trying to constrain the nature of the dark matter, the nature of the dark energy, as much as we can. And so it turns out that by imaging the diffuse gas, you can actually avoid the complexity of star formation in several ways. Before the first galaxies formed, obviously there were no stars around. So by definition, it's just a physics problem, just like observing the cosmic microwave background before the first stars formed. And so at those high redshifts, above redshift 25, we can map in principle the fluctuations in the distribution of the gas using the 21 centimeter transition without worrying about star formation. Then during granization, it turns out that we can actually do the same by fishing out a special effect due to peculiar velocities, which are induced just by gravity. And by focusing on this effect of peculiar velocities, we can separate the physics from the astrophysics. And then after the universe gets ionized, even then there are still pockets of neutral hydrogen left behind, and they sit mainly inside galaxies. So we're effectively just imaging the distribution of galaxies at that point. And the distribution of galaxies on large scales does follow the distribution of matter. And you can study the initial conditions by observing the power spectrum of density fluctuations at late times this way. So why do we need to do all of that? Let me illustrate it by this plot on the top left here. What you see in red is the region that was imaged so far with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey using the luminous red galaxies going all the way out to redshift 0.3 typically. And you can ask which fraction of the cosmological volume was imaged. So this diagram actually shows in comoving coordinates the observable volume of the universe. So of course, as I said before, the maximum distance that we can probe is the speed of light times the age of the universe. What we can observe with telescopes is limited to a redshift of 1,000 because the universe was opaque before that. We can't see through that surface. And that's pretty close to the horizon because the time that elapsed between the Big Bang and when the universe became transparent was only 0.4 million years, a very short time. So we can see almost all the way out. Now, out of this volume that we can see, we have observed, as it turns out, if you ask what is the fraction, the cumulative fraction of the volume that we have observed, as a function of redshift, if you take a redshift of 0.3 for SDSS, you get 0.1%. So we haven't observed yet 99.9% of the observable volume of the universe. We have observed only 10^-3 of the, and all the cosmological parameters that I showed early on are based just on the 0.1% of the universe volume that we have observed. Now, we also have, aside from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, we have information from the cosmic microwave background, which comes to us from this redshift 1,000 surface. It's a two-dimensional surface. It's not a three-dimensional volume. We're looking just at a two-dimensional surface. And if you imagine a Fourier decomposition of all the modes on that surface, you can fit a certain number of independent modes, each of which has a characteristic wavelength, on that two-dimensional surface. But it's just a two-dimensional surface. You don't have as much statistics as if you were to probe the entire volume. And in fact, by probing the entire volume of the observable universe, we can improve the statistical confidence that we have in cosmological parameters by 2 orders of magnitude, it turns out. So, that's right. So SDSS-3 will actually try to do that by observing sources out to higher redshifts. Exactly right. And why is that important? Aside from cosmological parameters, we want to measure the amplitude of density fluctuations as a function of wave number. And although we have constraints on various scales, various wave numbers, these are the different Fourier modes that you can decompose the density fluctuations in units of inverse megaparsecs. We haven't really observed the short wavelength or the high K values. And the problem is that in the present day universe, these modes became nonlinear. The structures corresponding to these wavelengths collapsed already. So you really need to go to high redshifts when the universe on these scales was still in the linear regime. The physics was simple. And there are two advantages to probing the volume that I described before. First, of course, there is a bigger region of space that you are probing these modes in. But most importantly, you are looking at earlier times when these short wavelength fluctuations were in the linear regime. So there are several experiments currently being developed to observe the 21 centimeter emission or absorption from the early universe. These are the experiments. And it's a very exciting time. We're sort of at an infancy of a new field here. The theoretical work was almost completed. Basically, we did most of the calculations that can be done. It's now up to the experimentalists to do it. And it's exciting because if you look at the cosmic microwave background field, it started back in the 60s. It took 40 years. The young people that entered the field only over the past decade think that it's a piece of cake, that it's just easy. Within a decade, we got all these cosmological parameters. But in fact, it took many years of very hard work to develop the technology that allows us to have this page that I showed at the beginning of the cosmological parameters. So this, the same will probably happen here. There will be lots of obstacles. It will take some time before this field matures. But these experiments cost only tens of millions of dollars. They are not extremely expensive. And it's exciting to see a completely new dimension being opened up in cosmological studies. And that's how these experiments look like. You can see these dipole antennas, similar to the ones you can buy in RadioShack, because we're dealing with frequencies of order 80 or hundreds of megahertz, the same frequencies that you see on your FM dial on your radio at home. And the reason this was not done until now is because you need a lot of computer power to correlate the different dipoles. We're talking about thousands of dipoles. And this is from the experiment in Australia that will have the parameters mentioned here. And that's an artist illustration of this experiment. The experiment is done in the desert, far away from TV or radio stations. And just to illustrate the problem with getting close to a big city, if you get close to Sydney, there is a huge foreground from all the TV or radio stations that are operating out there. We're talking about meter wavelengths, wavelengths that have roughly the height of a person. And then as you go away from Sydney to a more remote area, you can see that the number of these spectral lines corresponding to specific radio stations or TV stations disappear. And then in Melora, one of the more remote places, there are not so many of them. So in fact, this observation that we have this foreground of man-made, human-made interference led us to consider the possibility that in fact, if there are civilizations out there, extraterrestrials, that we can actually eavesdrop on their signals with this experiment. That if at the very least, we will get upper limits on interference from outside civilizations. It turns out that an Earth-like transmitter, if you take the Earth and move away from it, you can see the Earth out to tens of parsecs for the 50 light years or so. And the Earth has been emitting radio waves for 50 years or so. So there is this interesting coincidence that if one of these experiments is being performed out there, out to 50 parsecs, they will see us, in principle. And of course, one thing to keep in mind is that if we do detect any signal, we should not attempt to respond, because at least if you look at the history of transmission here on Earth, the strongest signal came out during Cold War with the Soviets, when there were anti-ballistic missile warning systems that were operating. So the strongest signals would come not necessarily from peace-loving terrestrials. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the past. And of course, an interesting question is what will happen in the future? And these are pictures of my two daughters that are mostly concerned about the future. So, yeah. Yes, so all the experiments that I showed are sensitive to redshifts between 6 and 15. Okay, and so they are mostly sensitive to the time when the universe got ionized by the first galaxy. It's very difficult to push the redshift frontier to higher redshifts, because there is a synchrotron foreground from the Milky Way galaxy, which is 4 to 5 orders of magnitude brighter than the signal that we're after. Now, you can calculate whether you can remove this foreground. And of course, the reason that people are optimistic about detecting the signal is because the foreground is smooth as a function of frequency. It's a synchrotron foreground that has a smooth dependence on frequency. You can fit it with a polynomial and then subtract it off. And what we are after, the signal is fluctuating with frequency, because each frequency corresponds to a different slice through the universe. So slight changes in the frequency correspond to different regions in the universe that should have a different image. And therefore, when you do the calculation, it turns out that we should be able to detect the signal, even though it's 4 orders of magnitude or 5 orders of magnitude less than the foreground. But the foreground has frequency dependence. It gets brighter as you go to lower frequencies. And therefore, it's more difficult to push to higher redshifts than 15. Going below 6 is doable. And in fact, there is a project in Canada, that a proposal out to do that. And the point is that we realized that it's interesting to explore only a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, after the other experiments were already targeting the epoch of reionization. And also the technology is different because these are higher frequencies that we're talking about at low redshifts. The signal is weaker because there is less neutral gas at low redshifts. However, the foreground is much weaker. So it turns out the signal to noise is not unreasonable. It's comparable to that during reionization. And so that's why it would be interesting to explore that frontier as well. You can do baryonic oscillations, for example, studies using the 21 centimeter. And here you're not resolving individual galaxies. It's just like a galaxy survey without resolving individual galaxies, because you're just looking at the modulation in the 21 centimeter signal on large scales without resolving individual galaxies. Okay, so let me move on to the future. Now, the one important discovery that came about a decade ago is that the universe is accelerating. You must have heard about that. And that means that if we are observing a galaxy at a certain distance from us, it recedes away from us. Hubble already discovered that 90 years ago, 85 years ago. But it's not only receding away from us, it's receding with a velocity that is increasing with time. So if we imagine that there is a cosmological constant, in other words, the vacuum energy density is constant with time, the vacuum will not decay in the future, in the immediate future, then this acceleration will continue. And so imagine this distant galaxy, as time goes on, it moves faster and faster away from us, eventually moving at the speed of light. So once it reaches the speed of light, even light will not be able to reach us from that galaxy. And after some time in the rest frame of that galaxy, we will not be able to see the radiation coming from it. So we will lose causal contact with that galaxy. If there is a guy with a cell phone calling us, at some point, we will not be able to know what is going on there because we will not receive any signals beyond a certain time in the rest frame of that person. So that will happen to all the distant galaxies. At some point, they will disappear from view. In fact, what will happen, it's very similar to a source that is falling into the horizon of a black hole. The image will freeze at the time when the source entered the horizon. And the same will happen here. The image of all the distant galaxies will freeze at the time when they reach the speed of light. And beyond that time, the image will fade away and will disappear from view, and we will not know what happened in that galaxy beyond that time. And for galaxies at different redshifts, this will happen at different times into the future. So what I plotted here, this is from a paper that I wrote. It took me one day to write. I thought about the idea when I showered in the morning, submitted the paper the following day. It's a very simple calculation. The emission time is illustrated in the vertical axis and the observation time in the horizontal axis, and for different sources. And it turns out that when you see the curves flattening, that means that you are basically, it doesn't matter how long you continue to observe the source, you will see it not evolving beyond a certain time in its rest frame, because you won't be able to see how things developed beyond the time when the source reached the speed of light. And that's pretty depressing if you think about it. It means that extragalactic astronomy will stop being interesting beyond some time in the future. We will not be able to observe any galaxy in the future, distant future. And when I say distant future, we're talking just about a factor of 10 or so from the present age of the universe. It's not you don't need to extrapolate by many orders of magnitude. So the situation is similar to imagining ants walking on the surface of a balloon. And of course, as the balloon expands, the ants are traveling across that surface, and the distance that they can traverse depends on the speed by which the balloon is expanding relative to the speed by which they walk on the surface. So in fact, if the rate by which the balloon is being blown up is higher than the speed by which the ants are traveling on the surface, then of course they will never visit a region bigger than some size. They will never be able to see the entire surface. And so the ants are analogous to photons, and the balloon is analogous to the expanding space. space is expanding at an exponential speed, and therefore the region that we can see out to gets smaller and smaller in comoving coordinates. And some years ago, about 6 years ago, we actually tried to simulate what would happen to all the galaxies in the neighborhood of the Milky Way as you propagate their expansion into the future. And of course, you might recognize some of these names, the Coma Cluster, the Great Attractor, Perseus, and so forth. And then if you go to a time that is 6 times or 7 times larger than the present age of the universe, the region, our horizon actually is within the distance to the Great Attractor. So we will not be able to see the Great Attractor. It's already out of our horizon. And that's only when the universe will age by a factor of 7. And then eventually, the interesting question is, how many galaxies will reside within our event horizon? In 100 billion years, when the universe ages by a factor of 10 or so? And the answer is only one. Only our galaxy will be observable to us. And in fact, it's not our galaxy, it's the merger product of the Milky Way and Andromeda. So this is an artist illustration from an article that we posted on Astronomy Magazine about the collision between the Milky Way and Andromeda. And this future collision is the only object that will stay visible to us in the very distant future. And as it turns out, the collision will occur within the lifetime of the sun, within a few billion years from now. It will change the night sky completely. That will be exciting to observe. And we tried to simulate it with T.J. Cox a couple of years ago. This is the only paper of mine that has a chance of being cited in a few billion years time. So here is the illustration. You can see the two galaxies, the Milky Way here and the Andromeda galaxy approaching it. Even if it has some transfer speed, it turns out it doesn't matter much for the collision because of dynamical friction. The two galaxies are brought together for all reasonable set of parameters. And let me show you what happens when the two galaxies come together. So on the left, you will see the gas, and on the right, you see the stars. And see that the stars get mixed together, and you end up with an elliptical galaxy that looks quite similar to other galaxies we find in the universe. It's just that the Milky Way galaxy is a late bloomer. It actually ends up colliding with another disk galaxy similar to it, relatively late in the evolution of the universe. But within a few billion years, we will end up in an elliptical galaxy. So the night sky, of course, will be very different. And here you can see the sequence of events. 5 billion years ago, the two galaxies were farther apart. They're approaching each other today, and eventually they will coalesce. And the first passage is within 2 billion years, and then there will be a second passage, and eventually they'll make just one elliptical galaxy. An interesting question is what will happen to the sun, the solar system, and here we illustrated all the particles that are 8 kiloparsecs away from the center of the Milky Way galaxy, because we don't know exactly where the sun would be in its orbit when Andromeda will hit the Milky Way. So the distribution of these points, the red points, is illustrated here in the bottom as a delta function at 8 kiloparsecs initially. And then this ring of red particles gets dispersed by the passage of Andromeda. And you can see within 2 billion years from now, the probability distribution gets much broader. And then there are these arms that are developed in the Milky Way. And there is some chance that the sun will be relatively far from the center. Then Andromeda comes back again. And the interesting thing is that it steals some of these red dots. So there is a chance that the sun will get bound to Andromeda, and we will see the Milky Way from a distance when this happens. That would be quite nice. And then 4.5 billion years into the future, you end up with an elliptical galaxy. And the most likely distance of the Sun at that point from the center of the merger remnant is about 30 kiloparsecs or so. Of course, the Milky Way has a black hole at its center. And an interesting question about the black hole is, we've never observed the black hole directly, but could we, in principle, probe the space-time in its vicinity? And you can imagine the Verizon guy that you might have seen in TV commercials being placed closer and closer to the black hole in the center of the Milky Way galaxy. The size of the black hole at the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius A star, is about 10 million kilometers. And of course, this person, as it gets close to the horizon, as I mentioned before, the image will freeze, it will become red, and we won't be able to receive any signals from the cell phone that this person is holding. He will continue to listen to us, of course, and then he will have about 10 minutes before he's crushed by the central singularity. But he will pass through the horizon with no problem. The surface gravity is about a million times that here on the surface of the Earth, but the tidal forces are minuscule, so this person will actually live through this experience. However, we don't want to subject a person to these very drastic measures. And of course, if there is a more elegant way of probing the horizon, and one way to do that is by imaging the black hole in the middle of the Milky Way galaxy. And let me show you how the image would look like. So this is, if you put a flashlight orbiting around the black hole like a hotspot, it would move like this around the center, and then the images that you would see are illustrated here in the middle. And you can see the effects of gravitational lensing as you get these beautiful arcs surrounding the silhouette, the shadow of the black hole in the middle. And when the hotspot is approaching us on one side, you get more emission because of the Doppler effect. So there are plans actually to go after these images, and that's how the images would look like of the silhouette of the black hole at different frequencies, and if you include the blurring by the interstellar medium. There is also a chance to do the same thing in M87, which is a nearby galaxy and has a black hole which is about 1,000 times or 700 times more massive, but the distance is 2,000 times farther. And there was actually a claim a couple of weeks ago that the mass of the black hole is actually 6 × 10⁻⁹ solar masses, twice as large as traditionally thought. And if that's true, then the size of the image would be the same as that in the center of our galaxy. And in this case, one would be able to see also these silhouettes. So how can we image a black hole? There are plans to do that using an array of telescopes at millimeter wavelengths, spread throughout the globe. And here you can see some of these observatories. And by correlating the signal from all these observatories, it's as if you have a telescope with a dish that is as big as the size of the Earth. And with such a telescope, you can image the two black holes that I mentioned. So there is a chance that within a few years, we'll obtain such an image. In fact, this is one of the exciting frontiers. And when Andromeda and the Milky Way will come together, the two black holes at the centers of Andromeda and the Milky Way will also come together, and some interesting phenomena will take place. In particular, there will be emission of gravitational waves. The emission will not be the same in all directions, and because the waves carry momentum in a preferred direction, the remnant black hole that results from the merger of the two black holes will get a kick in the opposite direction. And all of these events will be, of course, interesting to monitor. So let me summarize what I described. My talk had two parts, one about the past of the universe, which we're trying to get a complete picture of by either imaging galaxies at early cosmic times or the gas in between the galaxies. And as I mentioned, we haven't really observed 99.9% of the cosmic volume as of yet. So for young people like you, there is a lot to do, actually, in the future. And we cannot observe the future, but we can predict it, and that makes life interesting. And of course, the one interesting result that will happen in the future is that the Milky Way and Andromeda will come together and make one galaxy, which I call the Milkomeda. And this galaxy is the only object that will remain visible to us in the very distant future. Thank you.